This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly look at the best in architecture, aircraft, furniture and fashion. I'm Josh Fennett. In today's show, we're talking travel, and as the world gets moving after a pandemic, we're wondering how plane interiors might have to change and asking why so many airports seem to be designed for the, well, let's say, short haul. Journalist Anthony Paletta tells us how terminals can aim higher.
You cannot think of this as an aesthetic object first. You must think of its functional requirements and build once those are firmly in mind.
And our Helsinki correspondent Petri Bertsov dips past an exhibition on how travel has inspired designers.
There's a lot of things that you can't really experience online. The atmosphere of a space or the smells of, you know, nature somewhere, or how the temperature feels, you know, on your skin. It's not available online.
All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24. Do stay tuned. Now, to set the scene, let's hear from Monocle's transport correspondent, Gabriel Lee, on the aviation industry's current state and reputation. He thinks a few smart changes could help passengers fall back in love with flying all over again.
At the start of the year, most planes were full, airlines were raking in profits, airports were growing, and aircraft were rolling off assembly lines at a record clip. But over the past few months, it's been a different picture. Thousands of planes have been parked, many terminals shuttered, and most flight crews grounded. Some say that pandemics act as accelerators, and that acceleration might be especially pronounced for the aviation industry. Its $570 billion annual passenger revenue is likely to be cut by more than half this year, and 25 million aerospace and aviation jobs are at risk. Overnight, the industry's future has gone from being a safe bet to up in the air, or not, as it were. If you looked hard, though, the cracks were showing even before the pandemic. The virus is like a sudden decompression in an aircraft that already needed serious maintenance. It's bad, but also represents an opportunity for a refocusing of priorities, a chance to recognize the value of aviation and to correct its course. During the past decade, many airlines have piled on ever more flights and packed ever more seats onto their aircraft, pushing a kind of mass tourism race to the bottom. Stressed passengers hated the experience, while harried flight attendants hated their passengers and employers in equal measure. Meanwhile, aviation emissions had taken center stage and started to push people away from flying in Europe. Even as in places such as Asia, the number of air passengers has continued its meteoric, and some would say unsustainable, rise. Bottom-of-the-barrel budget air travel and the growth-at-all-costs attitude that's associated with aviation hasn't been good for its reputation or the planet. The effects of the pandemic on the industry will be far-reaching. Smaller airlines will fold. Some, including Flybe and Germanwings, already have. Cabin designs will be reconsidered. Airports will rethink expansion plans. And supply chains will need to be reconfigured. We're already seeing a highly visible sanitizing of cabins, the wearing of masks on board, and increased screening for illness and symptoms in airports. As cash flow dwindles, there might be a temptation for manufacturers to put off investment in new technology and projects. That would be a mistake. The industry has the opportunity to champion innovation and create new green jobs while helping to restore economic health across the board. That's both the right thing to do and its best chance for a quick comeback. The challenges facing aviation's many stakeholders are daunting, but throughout the supply chain, this is an opportunity for a reset. Many industry players had become blinded by hubris with regards to passenger satisfaction, employee welfare, and the environment. This slowdown might push many to set their priorities straight, but it could also be a time to remind the world of what they miss about the magic and freedom of flight.
That was an excerpt from our June issue of the magazine. Many thanks to Gabriel Lee. We'll be hearing more about aeroplane interiors next. The airline industry is in a bit of a pickle. It needs to sell seats to generate money and make up for lost revenue, but space on board is at a premium and some physical distancing needs to be maintained. Factory Design is an agency specializing in aeroplane interiors, which has come up with a temporary and cost-effective solution, which it's calling the Isolate. This pleasing screen divider and armrest can be installed between passenger seats and is one of a raft of creative solutions to keep passengers safe within the confines of a plane. Monocle's Nick Manise caught up with Factory Design's director, Adam White, to discuss the product and talk more broadly about the future of cabin interiors.
It was a response to early news items describing middle seats needing to be blocked off on aircraft and other things like trains, perhaps. There's nothing worse on an aircraft than a wasted seat. So we decided to design something that could be put into that seat that improved security between one passenger and the next with the screen. So there's a sort of vertical screen between the two passengers that would sit either side of Isolate. And also you can add facility like a broader armrest, perhaps a coffee cup rest, and make something out of it. So that was broadly the sort of visual idea for Isolate.
You touched on the fact that the Isolate is a conceptual design that you produced in response to those news reports, but you're a firm with 20 years of experience when it comes to airline interiors. You've worked with the likes of Delta Airlines on their business class seats and even on the final iteration of the Concorde. Given your experience and industry knowledge, what sort of permanent changes could we maybe expect to see in the design of cabins in light of this pandemic?
I think there's no doubt that the current pandemic will impact on the way that people like us at Factory Design are briefed. You know, the briefs historically in recent years have had a lot to do with luxury and boutique hotel, but equally or as a balance, they've also talked a lot about weight saving and lightness and that kind of economy. And I think we have no doubt that one of the new, more strongly stressed criteria will be examining antimicrobial finishes and, to a degree, physical protection. So I think in commercial aviation, we can improve the sort of architecture to a degree. I think where the sort of heroic work will be done will be at a sort of trim and finish level. Some very smart materials are going to be ramped up for use that stop the spread of disease.
So we're talking about surfaces and finishes, but Adam, I'm curious if passenger loads will also be re-examined. Airlines have been experiencing reduced passenger numbers in recent months, and obviously that links to the profitability of flights. I mean, so many budget airlines are built on the idea of cramming as many people on board as possible. Is now the time for them to perhaps re-evaluate their models in this regard?
To keep current passenger loads, you rely on a sardine tin model in coach class. You cannot provide material protection between passengers with the current seat pitch and width. It's not going to happen. When you're down at the front of the aircraft in business and first class, what you buy is real estate. The more money you spend, the more space you give. Like every business in the world that's been so seriously affected, I think we will see price of travel rise. What I'd love to see is an elevation in the product at the same time. If we were able to, if you think about doing away with the whole business of economy, premium, business and first, and you imagine a more egalitarian platform, which in a way is a lot more like it used to be a long time ago, where you'd have more generously pitched and spaced seats from one end of the aircraft to the other. If we put the business of lying flat aside for longer or ultra-long haul flights, I think you could redefine the whole experience of flying by re-examining the way that airlines have typically treated the division of passengers in terms of spend.
And Adam, just to round up this discussion, I think you've made it clear that making people feel comfortable in a cabin is key to getting them flying again. With this in mind, what's the most important moves that designers of airplane interiors need to make in the next few years, or what can we expect?
I would say that for the near future, probably the next year or so, I think there will be a lot of short-term fixes to provide a degree of cover and a degree of genuine protection, but equally to help manage passengers' expectations of how the cabin should be adjusted and indeed just to make them feel better about getting back into aircraft. Longer term, because everything to do with new cabin interiors is a longer term job, I think that we will see new materials being introduced. And indeed, that could lead to a degree of new aesthetic. There are some materials that are very obviously easy to clean and others less. If you think of a domestic environment, a carpet is a much more difficult thing to guarantee is clean than a hardwood floor, for instance. or a, you know, a sort of rubberized type floor. So I think that there are materials that naturally could be replaced to increase the sense of cleanliness in a cabin. But on the other hand, there are some brilliant technologies. Boeing several years ago released a new concept toilet that when you were outside the loo and the door was shut, a UV light would blast the inside of the space for 30 seconds or so. And that UV light was extremely good at killing germs of all sorts. You know, I imagine that there's a faster pace of development for those sorts of ideas.
My many and sincere thanks to Adam White. He was speaking to Monocle's Nick Manise. Thanks, Nick. Now, in comparison to many buildings, airports lead strikingly short lives. At the mercy of rapid changes in aviation technology, in security, health, and even from the odd app-based taxi company, the way we use these buildings changes fast and can render them unfit for purpose almost as soon as they're fully operational. Now, to discuss why airports are so vulnerable to change and how they can future-proof themselves, Monocle's Charlie Filmer-Court spoke to Anthony Paletta, a freelance journalist in New York who writes about architecture, design and urbanism. Charlie began by asking why airports have such limited lifespans.
The central stress that I've encountered from research and speaking to a number of airport architects is just majority of buildings do not deal with massive alterations in the volumes of humans passing through them. There's just no comparison. Most buildings accommodate a finite number of people, or other transport infrastructure, railroad stations aren't suddenly dealing with octupling increases in capacity. The main brief trouble is that it's a facility wherein if you add people at any point, you often strain the capacity of the whole building. So an effort, you know, an increase at one point accordions throughout the whole structure. And airports are generally reasonably good at accommodating some modest increases, but the increases have been exponential in many cases over the long jet age stretching from the 1950s.
Chances are you've heard about the plane with a spiral staircase in first class. The plane with the two wide aisles and the three widescreen movies and the 8-foot ceilings and economy.
The rapid increase in plane size, which prior to 1959, when the Boeing 747 entered service, majority of planes held about 100 passengers at most. You found that rapidly quadrupled, and up to in recent ages, the Airbus A380 can carry 853 passengers. There might be larger trains that emerge, but you're simply not handling a train that has eight times as many passengers as the prior would in any kind of terminal. It's these increases that strain and rendered all sorts of earlier airports obsolete. And even today, we find if we've reached a sort of plateau in which the Airbus A380 is sort of too big, it's been discontinued because the number of airports that can accommodate it are quite few. So there's kind of a plateau with that, but the principal problem was airplanes just steadily getting bigger. You had these vast increases in capacity required in every particular, which isn't just new jetways and concourses. It's more seating area. It's more retail, larger security areas. It's invisible elements like the amount of space for baggage handling. Many airports simply weren't equipped to handle and had to conduct fast renovations for things that most people never see.
Les passagers pour le vol Air Arabia Maroc 116 à destination de Nador sont priés de se rendre immédiatement à la porte B33.
The main stress that I've encountered, the repeat mantra from a variety of current airport architects, is simply to build in flexibility. There are two principal aspects to that. The one being that the structures you build should possess interiors that are as flexible as possible. I'm sure many have seen more recent vast terminal structures that resemble airplane hangars themselves. Those are ideal in terms of you just don't know what is going to come along next. You should build a building that can accommodate the unknown, which is, knowing that that's oxymoronic, one should build as flexible a space as possible. The second element is in terms of actually handling planes, airports should be built in such a way that additional concourses can be anticipated and added on. Knowing that there are many airports in which runway space is tightly hemmed in urban areas, etc. In any case possible, when you're building an airport, you should anticipate, well, if this needs to grow, how are we going to do that? In which direction we do that? And it spares vast effort if you know, well, this direction we could add on another wing or whichever, then having them for, you know, someone else dealing with that in 20 years and potentially tearing your whole structure down.
Último aviso a los señores pasajeros del vuelo Ryanair 6002 con destino Sofía. Embarquen urgentemente por la puerta número 4.
One template that has been pretty flexible is actually, oddly enough, sort of early large rectangular structures. There was a fair amount of praise for the Dulles Airport in Washington, D.C., and there was a lot of praise for sort of the largest relatively rectangular central structures you could build in terms that those were easiest to adapt. As compared to, it seems one often runs into trouble with more circular or unusual shapes in terms of it just being difficult to expand them in one direction or another. A rectangle, there's generally the relative ease in building left or right or north or south along those cardinal directions, whereas more unusual shapes tend to come with their own constraints.
All other passengers are kindly requested to remain seated for the moment. Please have your own boarding card ready for inspection.
It's important not to lose sight of design qualities, but I feel some architects approach this in the wrong way in terms of you cannot think of this as an aesthetic object first. You must think of its functional requirements and build once those are firmly in mind. And I don't think that it obviates the possibility for wonderful aesthetic expression. I mean, architects were praising the Aerosarin and Dulles Terminal, which is a wonderful landmark for functioning well while still being an architectural landmark. I mean, I think that Moshe Safdie's Singapore Airport looks marvelous. It is also extremely functional, but I think that one needs to keep in mind that functional requirements are paramount and that enter into the considerations at the second point, or else you end up with these tremendously expensive replacement efforts every few decades.
Departure of flight Voltaire 3607 to Asturias.
Please board via gate number
7.
In the past, the taxi queue was a relatively straightforward process. Airports regimented this fairly well in terms of get into the queue and proceed. Uber's blown that system apart in which you're not getting into a line, you're looking for your driver you've already chosen. And I think that a practice of converting nearby lots, sometimes it'd be cell or mobile phone lots or others that have been converted, I think that these necessarily will involve and have involved in redesign lots that are slightly more distant from a terminal, because you just can't accommodate that level of waiting in your main roadway, no matter how many lanes you have. If the driver for X is waiting there and the passenger is another 10 minutes away and someone else is waiting for someone who's there in 3 minutes, and it's chaotic.
In your own interest, please don't leave your luggage unattended.
Bitte achten Sie jederzeit auf Ihr Handgepäck.
A lot of post 9/11 security screening was essentially inserted into flexible spaces. There are, unfortunately, many large head houses that were designed mainly as sort of grand open spaces in which they were then consumed by security screening, which is unfortunate, but worked fairly well in terms of an existing structure incorporating something that they needed. In other cases, I think I had just been reading the other day about the Stansted expansion, actually, which is involving another building for security screening. And that's frequently been required. And I wouldn't be surprised if it's required much more often in the future, when the concern isn't merely bottlenecks in the sense that we've known them, but if we're avoiding bottlenecks at the space of not 2 or 3 feet between people, but 6 feet or 2 meters or whatever between people, it's going to require much more space. And to a large extent, there's no way to anticipate these things aside from building the largest, most flexible spaces you can.
Our thanks to journalist Anthony Paletta in New York, and he was speaking to Monocle's Charlie Fillmore-Court. Thanks, Charlie. Next, buckle up, because we're off to Finland. Earlier this spring, Helsinki's Design Museum postponed its latest exhibition, Travel as a Tool. Now it's finally opened, the content of the show, which looks at how travel or a lack of it can influence the design world, seems more timely than ever. Our Helsinki correspondent Petri Bertsov met up with the exhibition's curator and one of its participants, and he brings us this report.
Traveling affects our societies more than we might think. The Finnish Design Museum's new exhibition titled Travel as a Tool examines the interplay between travel and design. Through the work, photographs, and travel diaries of key Finnish and Nordic designers, the exhibition showcases the essential role that travel has played in influencing the built environment around us. Designers travel to find new inspiration and to discover new methods and materials in faraway lands. For the Danish architect Jørn Utzon, the time he spent with the indigenous peoples in Mexico taught him about the ancient Mayan techniques and left a clear mark on his architectural style that is visible in his best-known works, such as the Sydney Opera House. The Finnish architect Alvar Aalto considered his time in Italy absolutely essential to the development of his modernist style. But what happens when traveling stops? It's a question that is very pertinent right now amid the coronavirus pandemic and the environmental concerns surrounding the global travel industry. Does a society lose its frame of reference? What happens to those random encounters and moments of serendipity that often lead to magical discoveries? The Helsinki-based Finnish-Korean artist Aamu Song explains.
Like meeting real human is different than like FaceTime. For me, it's a pilgrimage to go to meet this maker. And when you meet this person, it's like you have never been in winter or snow. If you're living in warm countries, but you can learn about snow with the internet. But when you see the snow, it's like, oh, and that one experience stay forever.
Song believes that traveling has been essential for the development of her and her partner Johan Ulin's design language. They have traveled around the globe in search of old manufacturing methods and traditions.
Everything we changed how we think. They are the king. They are really God in this material manufacturing world. And many of them were making not really only for money, but with the family tradition and for neighbors and for their cultural history. So we were heavily influenced and we learned how things are made. So it was more like a new school for us.
What about if you think about your own life story? If I understood correctly, you are from Korea and you have moved to Finland, so you are already part of both cultures or maybe between two cultures. Do you think that can be somehow seen in the work that you do?
Maybe, because I'm having such an opposite or so different cultural background than Finland. And I see something always differently. And maybe something so boring for Finns, it looks so refreshing and so clever to me. So I learned maybe through living in Finland for 22 years how to see things in different way, and I think or these minority people can see majority culture or things in a new perspective and learn even better than the locals.
Design, of course, does not stop even if travel is restricted. In the information age, knowledge is available online and we don't need to travel to connect with the outside world. I asked the exhibition's curator Anna Vihma about the future of design in a world that travels less.
having just seen the exhibition, it's clear and very evident that for many designers, traveling has meant first and foremost coming into contact with new civilizations, new ideas and concepts of beauty, new techniques, new materials, new crafts. In today's world, so much of this knowledge is already available online. One could also, a little bit provokingly, ask if travel is still necessary.
Well, I think that this is a good chance to sort of reflect on if all of our travels are really necessary and if there could be something to change there. When you look at the travels of past decades of designers, one thing that's really visible there is that when traveling hasn't been as feasible and as easy, and the possibilities haven't been like they are nowadays, individual travels have been maybe planned quite a lot meticulously, so that it's not only about going from A to B, but there's often different things connected to one travel, so that you might visit 5 different places on the way from A to B. The program might be a bit more carefully planned, because it's not like you could go there easily next month again, but it might be like a once-in-a-lifetime experience. Even though we definitely can be a bit more mindful about the amount of traveling, I really strongly believe that it's important to travel for designers and for all of us, and for different reasons. There's a lot of things that you can't really experience online. The atmosphere of a space, or the smells of, you know, nature somewhere, or how the temperature feels, you know, on your skin. It's not available online. And also, I think that this sort of experience of feeling like an outsider, of feeling like dislocated and not understanding anything about what's going on, it's really valuable, and it does good to everyone every once in a while.
As I leave the exhibition, I start to reflect on the nature of travel and how isolation affects us. It is not just about the individual designers and their travels, but about the way in which societies function. Being isolated means losing perspective of the scale and space around us. To understand how design works and how it affects the different places, peoples and cultures, we need to see, feel and experience. In other words, to be present. For Monocle in Helsinki, I'm Petri Purtsov.
Many and sincere thanks to Petri Burtsoff for that report. And the exhibition, Travel as a Tool, is on at the Design Museum in Helsinki until March 2021. And sadly, that's all the time we have on today's show. But if you're game for a few more design delights, then do listen to our 5-minute midweek sister show, Monocle on Design Extra, that airs on Thursdays, and do subscribe so you don't miss a beat. For more delights, you can seek out or subscribe to Monocle magazine on newsstand or online, sign up to our daily bulletins, or head to monocle.com for our collaborations, books and the like. Today's show was produced and edited by the ever-patient Maylee Evans. Thanks to our researchers, Nick Manise and Charlie Filmer-Court. Thanks, guys. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.